Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to season 2, episode number 3 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in Wellington is Kaylee Carruthers. G'day, Kaylee.
Hello, Dan.
What a pleasure it is to have you here. Before this is the eve of your elevation to professional national radio fame and fortune. We may not actually be able to get you back after that.
Oh, no, that's not true. It's a temporary gig. A temporary gig.
Well, so. You know, once people hear you, they're going to struggle to let you go.
That's how I got on there, is this voice, this lady voice is taking me places, Dan, and I have to thank you for that.
Well, you know, I'm
and
nothing.
And my mom and dad.
Yeah, I'm nothing if not a talent spotter. Well, listeners, what is on today's show? First of all, after the two epic weeks that we've just had, where one show we had to split into two because it was so long, and last week's show was still well over an hour, we're going to try and get in and out like ninjas today. So we just have the one review to do and one spoken feature, and hopefully that means that we'll all be around the dinner table before you know it. Everyone's been talking about it, so why shouldn't we? Christopher Nolan's latest eye film, Interstellar. We'll be doing that on the show a little bit later on. Plus, James Cameron. Yes, we have exclusive audio from the live Skype Q&A that he did at Wellington's Embassy Theatre on Labour Monday. He was talking about Deep Sea Challenge 3D, which is in cinemas at the moment. We're going to remind you also and update you about our Studio Ghibli competition. All of that, you know, plus the usual plethora of new stats, opinion, etc., etc., etc. First up, Kaylee, you have some mailbag for us.
So much mailbag this week. Thank you, everyone, for chatting with us online. Let's start with Fred Thompson, because he sent us a two-part
We should just call this the Fred segment. The Fred Zone.
We need to sting people. We're looking for two new stings. Okay? Okay.
Yabba dabba do.
Two-word review for Interstellar: Space Oddity. Enigmatic and visually amazing, ambitious and full of grandeur, so can forgive ham-fisted exposition, that booming overloaded soundtrack, and the running time.
You can forgive. Anyway, we're going to talk about Interstellar a little bit later on.
We have an entry for our contest from the lovely Doug Dilliman, known as Dillamonster on Twitter. In regards to your contest, because I am an ostensible adult with three separate Totoro-related stuffed toys.
I think that's a pretty good reason.
Yeah.
We're looking for more reasons for this your entries to our Studio Ghibli competition. We're going to keep it going for another couple of weeks because we want a high quality entry level and list. And do you want me to do the two? We've got two emails. Entries, because you know, we don't often get emails that aren't me emailing myself to remind me of things,
or my mum and dad.
True. So here we go. Joe Dixon DDA. Hi guys, I'd love to win the Studio Ghibli prize. The first Ghibli film I saw was Princess Mononoke at a theater in Auckland over a decade ago, and I was just gobsmacked by how stunning it was. I've seen perhaps another half dozen of their films over the years during festivals, but Mononoke and Spirited Away are the only ones I have at home. I'd love to have some more titles to watch again and share with my family to introduce them to the amazing stories and animation of Studio Ghibli. So that's Joe. That's setting a pretty high bar. This is the thing, is that if you email us, you can go into slightly more detail. But then with Doug's minimalist tweeting, you know, there's some bonus points to be got there as well. Lisa Rennick said, Kaylee and Dan, in common with all of your listeners, I have long had a love for cinema. Like you, Dan, I shared that love with my children when they were growing up. Now that they are young adults, this had meant that their interests sometimes diverge from those of their peers. My elder daughter believes that Withnail and I is the funniest movie she has ever seen, and forces her friends to watch it, even when it is clear that they would rather be watching Hangover 3. Well done. My younger daughter idolizes Audrey Hepburn and Grace Kelly rather than Kim Kardashian, although, to be honest, she does sometimes watch the Kardashians. It is in my son, however, that my passion is truly shared. At the age of 23, his favourite genre is film noir. His favourite director is Akira Kurosawa, and he is firmly convinced there hasn't been a decent movie made in the last 40 years, except that is for the films of Studio Ghibli. I am reluctant to admit that the student has well surpassed the master, and my son has a knowledge and interest in these films that I know little about. My hope is that if I was to win a prize in your competition, I could watch these films with my son and he could share with me his knowledge and enthusiasm as I once tried to with him. Aww. Thanks and keep up the good work. So, lovely.
Little heartstrings.
Top entries there. It's going to be a difficult judging session, isn't it?
Get a little misty-eyed from that one. Mark Rolston tweeted his two-word review for Interstellar, which that's most of the two-word reviews we have today, so I'm going to read out a few of them because they're great. Astral condescension.
I like it too.
And Reese Pie said her two-word review for Interstellar, intergalactic poppycock. Also, quite funny, if you do follow us on Twitter, you may have been part of our conversation about having a special episode where we just have people come on and do their best/worst Michael Caine impressions. So that's great. So you should just check out that conversation. And a great review from Robert Caddo over in Sydney. Two-word review for Mike Lee's Mr. Turner. Never has a grunt meant so much and yet so said so little. It's probably one of my favorite tweets this week.
And also, scrolling back a little bit further, actually, we can talk a little bit about Mr. Turner maybe when we get to our top fives, because I got to see that this morning.
Did you?
I don't think it's embargoed. Sometimes it used to be that when there was an embargo, you had to sign something and you handed your cell phone in and all that sort of carry on. Now, you watch the film and then you ask the distributor if it's okay if you... you know, go put your review in a particular time, and they go, oh, did we not tell you? It's actually embargoed until da 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 da. I just had that a massive problem with the Water Diviner for the magazine. You know, it was like, oh, brilliant, perfect thing for the December, January issue. And then they went, nah. So finally, we managed to persuade them, but it was, you know, embargoes. Who knows? Mm. I may not be allowed to talk about the Water Diviner. I'm not allowed to talk about that.
Mm.
Can't tell you what I think of that, but Mr. Turner, I might
maybe play it safe.
Yeah, I know, because we want to stay on side with these lovely people that help us out.
I did miss Mr. Turner though. I couldn't fit it in, and it was one of those things at Telluride where it was like, oh, I could go see this and maybe get in, or I could go here.
Well,
you're
missing
this,
two other films. You pick Mr. Turner, you're losing two films.
But Mike Lee was there.
Stop it, you. Oh, man. I know that you just gave me a Telluride Film Festival staff cap for this year's festival.
And an official program. Which finally arrived.
And a neat little string bag or string tied bag.
Yes, the official staff goodie bag.
Right? And that's fantastic. And so I am not going to be as vocally envious about your trip as I have been in the past,
because you're fully kitted out.
I am.
You were there.
Yeah, I can, and if people ask me what was it like, I can say, well, you know, Mike Lee has a beard, because that's what I know.
Or you could tell them to listen to Radio New Zealand.
Yeah, you're going to be talking
Sunday.
About it this Sunday, right? You're going to be telling people all of your Channing Tatum proximity gossip.
Which is none.
All right. We've got another one here about Ghibli, actually, and that's Barnaby HM did try and correct us on our Ghibli pronunciation. He's – oh, crumbs. I should have read this before I started the show. In case no one said this already, Ghibli is pronounced Ghibli or Ghibli based on the katakana, and then he gives us the Japanese characters for it. So, sorry, Barnaby. I'm stuck in the Ghibli headspace now after last week's conversation, and I don't know if I can go back.
I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be okay.
I think you think they're not going to take the prizes away?
I think it'll be okay. I don't think we'll have a riot. I don't think people will be burning police cars in the street.
All right. Good to know.
Hopefully.
All right.
Be kind to us. We are but simple podcasters.
Indeed. Talking of simple podcasters, you were going to try and get to see...
Tusk,
which is the new Kevin Smith film. And tell me why that particular film was one that was on your list to try and get to this week.
That was on my list. I missed it at Vancouver International Film Festivals. I believe it was programmed there. I may be wrong. It may have been at another festival. Everything's a blur. But it's the new film from Kevin Smith, and it is about a podcaster who, I believe, goes to interview someone and gets kidnapped and turned into a walrus.
Excuse me?
Gets turned into a walrus.
I thought...
Not human centipede, a walrus.
See, I'd only heard the first part of that summary before, and I thought, oh, it's just like Misery, you know? But no, it's something else entirely.
It's a Kevin Smith film. Okay. And you said you read somewhere it was part of a trilogy.
Yeah, apparently that's what he's threatening us with. Yeah.
Well, Kevin Smith, there you go.
All right. let's just see now what people have been watching at the various box offices on the territories that we pay attention to. Kaylee, you have the Kiwi box office in front of you.
Yes, yes I do. In at number 5, all the way down from 3, is Gone Girl. Sitting in the number 4 position again this week is Pride. In 3, down from 2, is Fury. Sadly, bumped out of the number 1 position is The Deadlands into 2nd, and no questions here, number 1 is Interstellar.
Yeah, and that's without a 3D premium as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that's a good effort. Pride is a film that we haven't talked about on the podcast.
But did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm seeing a lot of love for it. Right. Oh. Mm. So it is one that I'm going to try and get to as well. Or definitely want to see it one way or another. In Australia, across the ditch, what have we got here? Number 5, Love, Rosie, opening a week before us. John Wick, opening at all. number 3, Fury, which has dropped right back in New Zealand. Mm. You know, didn't last the distance at all here. No love for Brad Pitt here. Gone Girl still at 2, and number 1, Interstellar.
In the US, in at number 5 is Fury. Number 4, taking a big tumble this week, Ouija. In at number 3, Gone Girl. Number 2, Interstellar. And in the number 1 position, which I'm so excited to see, Big Hero 6.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise, wasn't it, from most commentators, that Interstellar didn't quite crack the 50 million on that opening weekend. And it was, in fact, beaten to the punch by Big Hero 6. Although international box office for Interstellar, as we're demonstrating, has been pretty strong. So I don't think anybody's too worried about losing their shirts on it. But still, interestingly, you know, when I was watching Interstellar, I found myself thinking, you know what, this film really needs to be called Gravity, but that title was taken. And I wonder whether a year ago, in the middle of post-production or whatever Chris Nolan was, Gravity comes out and he's just going, God damn it, took my title.
We were talking about this last night at our flat, and that that Hollywood hive mind, I guess, where it's two films in, you know, the same year or similar years, and they're very similar or have similar themes. So, but it was funny, I couldn't really keep up with it, but the conversation was Armageddon versus Deep Impact and Gravity versus Interstellar, and we're trying to describe
whatever side of that line you fall is
but I couldn't figure out which one went with which, and they're trying to explain it to my friend who hadn't seen it, like, without spoilers, and it's like, no, Interstellar is the Deep Impact to Gravity, and it's like, no, Gravity's the Deep Impact. I was like, what are we even talking about?
Your flat has the best times. And on Gravity News, there's a new version of the Blu-ray, or a new Blu-ray version of Gravity. Ooh. That's just been released in the US, which has a version of the film with no musical soundtrack. So it's like the Silence of Space. Ooh. Version.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting, yeah, wouldn't it, to see,
oh,
to see
go see happens. That at the embassy. That'd be amazing.
Now, what I would love would be to watch a version of Interstellar without the blinking soundtrack. That would be interesting.
That'd be anyway. Great. That would be great. Are we going to Japan now?
No, UK first.
UK, right. Sorry.
I do that one, don't I?
Yes.
It's me. So top 5 in the UK last weekend, up to the 9th, number 5, Fury. Gone Girl at 4. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which has made £20 million. £1,000 in the UK. Just keeps going on and on and on. Number two in its second week in release, Mr. Turner, which I think is fantastic. A fantastic response for a British film, a small British film, and actually a film that is not big commercial box office. And number one, of course, Interstellar, straight in at number one, 1 week in, £5.33 million. As the BFI gives us a little bit of extra information on their stats, you can see some of the other films that are also playing further down the list. And you can see that Guardians of the Galaxy made another £6,000 in the UK. Now, there was something else. Oh, that's right. Opening next week, 14th of November, along with Diplomacy and The Drop, which are both going to get a release here. There's a film called Nativity 3, Dude, Where's My Donkey? I didn't know that there was a Nativity 1 and a Nativity 2, but there we go. Obviously, the people of the UK hanging out for the third part of that trilogy.
And this is the section where we go to edu-shaming. What are you doing over there? What are you doing?
Exactly. All right. Now, for a few weeks now, we haven't had either the time or the energy or the inclination to cast the net further afield. I still haven't combined Canada and the US. I'm sorry. We'll get to that.
We're working on it.
We are working on that. But let's have a look at Japan here, partly because I was listening to a podcast interview with the writer, co-writers and directors of Frozen. And I was thought, oh, I wonder if that's still number one in Japan, because it was for
ages.
Months. It was for months and months and months. Anyway, no, it's dropped out of the top 14 in Japan. We could actually work our way from five, Dracula Untold. Number four in Japan is something called Kinkyo Rirenai, or A Short Distance Relationship, which is a romantic comedy. Number three, The Expendables 3. Number two, Clover, another Japanese-made romance based on a famous manga there. And number one in Japan is the new version of Beauty and the Beast,
which I watched the trailer for today.
Right. Vincent Cassel, Lea Seydoux. I didn't even know this thing existed.
Mm-hmm.
So now you watched that in the capacity of your new job?
I heard about it through my new job. Okay. It doesn't have anything to do with it.
Right. Okay. But anyway, so interesting that's doing great guns in Japan without anybody even knowing about it anywhere else. Another interesting thing about the Japanese top 14, which is that, like, it's fully half of it is Japanese movies.
Oh, yeah.
And based on manga or franchise, you know, it is a world apart. There are a lot of films here that aren't even on, or a couple that aren't even on IMDb. You know, they're just making money. And, you know, it's an interesting country. My friend Martin Pepperell is in Japan at the moment.
Huh.
He's there for the Red Bull Academy, which is a big music event for a week with lots of stars turning up. I can't wait for him to come back to tell me a little bit more about just what the Japanese experience is like, because you look at what they're going to watch at the movies. Because even the Western stuff that's here, I mean, Grace of Monaco, number 9.
I'm staring at it. I can't look away.
Really? What is wrong? I mean, nothing wrong with you people. I mean, lovely people, but no, that's just weird. Right?
I was secretly hoping that La Belle et la Bête was the, like, original version.
First thought. It was like, really?
No. La Belle. La Belle.
All right.
I love that film so much.
It is. It's amazing. Did you saw it at the festival, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
Liberace Beast. So good.
A couple of weeks ago, I got an invitation to go and see a special screening of a film called Deep Sea Challenge 3D, which is not directed by James Cameron, but stars James Cameron, because he is the primary funder and leader of this incredible exhibition to go down to the very bottom of the Mariana Trench in a submersible, a trip that hadn't been made since 1963 or something like that. And even then, the Navy divers that did it only had a tiny window, so they never really had a chance to look outside and see what was there. So he's an absolute sort of gung-ho marine explorer, James Cameron, and, you know, whenever he gets some spare time and some spare cash, when he's not farming walnuts in the Wairarapa, he's funding these incredible exhibitions and all of this expeditions and all of this new technology in order to go down there. Anyway, the film was fascinating, really well made, what is a great National Geographic style documentary. And then following the film, he was in LA, and so there was a Q&A set up between him and the Embassy Theatre in Wellington, where members of the audience got a chance to ask questions. So we got a chance to record that, which is fantastic. So thank you very much to everybody concerned in that. Here's about sort of 10, maybe 15 minutes of the half an hour of the highlights of that conversation, because I have chosen there weren't very many questions about his filmmaking. Most were about the technology and the funding and what have you of the expedition, which has been covered in a lot of other areas. But we are going to have a couple of the questions about his filmmaking. Nobody asked him about the Terminator. Big opportunity
Amateurs.
Missed. Yeah. Keen-eared listeners may recognize a friend of Rancho Notorious, Doug Dillerman, asking one of these questions.
All right, well, the first thing I'd like to do is to thank James Cameron for the most wonderful movie that we all just witnessed, and it's testament really to his drive and his passion and his vision that he could actually pull something like that off. I know full well how incredibly difficult it is to do what he and his team did, so I think let's give him a big round of applause.
All right.
Thank you,
Cornel. I was just to say, well, thank you, and thanks, everyone. You know, obviously, I didn't make the film. I just made the sub, or led the team that made the sub. The film was directed by three directors. It was a team effort, and I'm not quite sure which was harder to do: build the sub and go dive it, or make the film about it.
Well, either way, the audience here was duly impressed, and we'd like to thank you and all your colleagues for what you've done.
Thanks.
What was your favorite dive of all time?
Well, that's very interesting. I have to choose, I guess, between my first dive to Titanic, having seen that, the deepest dive, obviously, to the Challenger Deep, which was such an accomplishment for our team. I guess I'd have to say the deepest dive, which you see at the end of the film, just because I really felt that I'd gone to another world. I felt that before, but that when I dove as deep as the Titanic with the Russians, but then that got put in context later as we went much farther into a much more remote place.
Hey,
never asked that question.
Hi. My name is Matthew Cowley, and where are you going to dive next?
Well, there are so many places that are interesting, and I know Cornell's got a long list as well, including some interesting sites in the Kermadec Trench and some of the volcanoes that are adjacent to it. Kermadec Trench was on our short list. We were going to dive in the Challenger Deep and then go to the Sirena Deep, which is about 75 miles away, and then we were going to go down to the Tonga Trench, right where it sort of merges into the Kermadec Trench system, and then we were going to dive longitudinally along that. But unfortunately, our dive program got cut down from 12 of the deep dives, really deep paddle dives, down to just a couple due to a tragic accident that happened early in the expedition. So we didn't get to do as much as we wanted. So on my bucket list is definitely diving the Kermadec Trench and the Tonga Trench and the Sirena Deep. I'm very interested in the Sirena Deep because we got a glimpse there of some microbial mats that were being powered by a process called serpentization, and they were down at 35,000 feet. So this is, we're looking really back into a very primordial way that life might have existed on the earliest days of the Earth.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Cameron. Inspirational movie, thank you very much. My name is Julian Hodge from the Marine Education Centre in Wellington. We have a government which seems to me to be determined to explore the ocean primarily for resource gratification, I guess, for mining and so on, and not so much for the sake of science. And I'm wondering if perhaps there may be something that you have in your mind on how we might be able to inspire our government, other New Zealanders, that perhaps that mineral exploitation is not necessarily what the ocean is for, but just for science's sake, and to gather knowledge.
Well, Julian, look, you're absolutely correct. And this is not just a problem in New Zealand, it's a problem everywhere, in the UK, Canada, in the United States, that there's such a dearth of money for pure exploration, which is why we could have possibly gotten into the second decade of the 21st century and not looked at these Hadal depths almost at all. That's why an area the size of North America exists on planet Earth that hasn't even been really looked at. And it's because it's too deep to really be able to exploit it with contemporary technology. It's hard enough just to get down there with cameras and lights and get back safely, let alone take mining equipment down there. But it's soon going to be practical, if not already, to mine, let's say, hydrothermal vent fields for their rich mineral content at depths of, say, 2 miles or even less. And, you know, so we have to think about whether it's really worth it to exploit these incredibly fragile and scientifically fascinating ecosystems just because of our endless demand for resources. I'd much rather favor, cutting back on our consumption of resources and our kind of endless fixation on more material goods, and preserve some of these habitats for the distant future.
I'm Duncan, and I have a question, which is, when you were young, you said that you wanted to be an explorer. Did you ever think about the possibility of directing films then?
No, it's interesting, Duncan. I was fascinated by science fiction. I read voraciously, and I love the idea of exploration. I couldn't think of, literally, like I say in the film, I couldn't think of anything I'd rather be than an explorer. The filmmaking bug came along later. I was late in high school, and then in college I got involved in filmmaking. And then that took me down another path. Originally I was directed more toward the sciences, and I studied physics and astronomy in my first 2 years in college. But then I switched majors to English, and I decided to be a storyteller. And then that led to writing, and that led to filmmaking. So I kind of turned my back on science, and I went back to it when I made the dives to film the movie Titanic in 1995. That got me very excited about the possibility of doing real deep ocean exploration. I realized I kind of had an affinity for it. And so then I took myself down a path of about 5 solid years of doing nothing but deep ocean exploration before I went back to filmmaking again with Avatar. So I've sort of gone back and forth between those two worlds. But it's interesting that you asked the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And the answer to it is really exploration came first.
Mr. Cameron, Bill, sorry about that. My name is Dave. I'm just wondering, with your donation of Deep Sea Challenger to the Oceanographic Institute that you were talking about, with the next dives you're planning, are you planning to have a more advanced version of that, or are you going to build a very, very similar vehicle?
Well, I would work with Woods Hole Oceanographic, and the plan would be that I would bring funding to the table, possibly jointly with them and other sort of corporate and academic sources that they might have available, and then we would dive the vehicle as a joint project. They own it at this point, but we would work cooperatively. The other option would be to harvest technologies from the vehicle and build something new, whether it's pilot.
piloted or remotely operated, or whether it's a fully autonomous robotic vehicle. I also sit on the board of the Center for Marine Robotics at Woods Hole Oceanographic, so I'm equally interested in robotic solutions as well. So this is something that I would discuss with them when we got our minds around the scope of the project that we wanted to do.
Okay, thank you. We're conscious of the fact that James is late in the evening where he is in Los Angeles, so we'll take three more questions.
It's okay. No problem. I like hanging out.
Hi, I'm George, and I was wondering, at a scale of 1 to 10, how nervous are you for a dive down to the trenches?
I was much more nervous before they opened the envelope of the Academy Awards in 1998, let me put it that way. I mean, in the sub, I could only die. All right, I'll put a little more meat on the bones of that. I would say I was apprehensive the night before any one of our dives, because every dive in the whole series of dives that you see in the film was a milestone where we were testing the sub, going deeper and deeper. We didn't really know what was going to happen. And the night before any one of those dives, I was fairly nervous, and I turned that nervous energy into writing out my checklist and being very, very thorough about the process of piloting the sub, because, you know, things could go wrong with the vehicle, but things could also go wrong if I treated the vehicle incorrectly or made the wrong decisions during the dive. So I had to pre-visualize the dive and get my head straight. By the time I got in the sub and it bolted that hatch shut, I was just excited. Everything, all the fear was behind me at that point. Everything exciting was ahead, and I was just, you know, really just in anticipation of what I was going to see, because I knew I was going to see something that I'd never seen before. I was very likely going to see something no human being had ever seen before.
Hi there. You mentioned in the introduction that it was as challenging to make the film as to do the dive. I was wondering if you could speak more to those challenges and also your challenges as a filmmaker suddenly being the subject instead of the filmmaker.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting being in front of the camera, and I had to kind of step back because there's no way I could be objective about the best way to tell a story that was centered on me. So I really relied on the directors who worked sequentially. They didn't work all together. And the editors to sort of manage that part of the storytelling and figure out how to tell that story. And I said, frankly, guys, I'm just going to get the sub in the water. I need to focus on the sub. I need to focus on my piloting and so on. And so that took 100% of my focus, and I let them make the film. The film was difficult to make because we had to take cameras and lights down into a very hostile regime for any kind of technology, and nothing existed off the shelf. We had to create camera housings, lenses. The cameras themselves that were used outside the submersible were built from the imager board up. So all the electronics were created by us in-house, and then housed, and then the optics done, and the fiber optic interface done, all the lights on the sub that you saw, the spotlights and the big array of lights up the front of the sub, those were created from scratch. And that's part of what happened during that 7-year program of doing all the materials testing and the electronics testing. We designed all those LED lights from scratch and built them and had to populate the sub with them, because we knew that it wasn't just a science vehicle, it wasn't just an exploration vehicle, it was an imaging platform. And if we weren't bringing back the images, then we weren't doing what explorers are supposed to do, which is come back and tell the story. It's not enough to just go and stick a flag in the ground. You have to come back and you have to tell the story. And part of that story is to the public, to get them excited about exploration and science. And part of the story is the story that needs to be told to the science community later. So you have to have good data, you have good instrumentation, you have to take good samples, and then you've got to do a good analysis after the fact before you publish. I think we were very successful in both aspects of that storytelling. But, you know, one of the biggest challenges was just building the equipment. Another challenge was filming on a ship when you're in the middle of a complex operation in stormy conditions. It's dangerous. There were a lot of things that were dangerous, not only for me inside the sub, but for the ship's crew, the filming crew that were working around the ship's crew on deck, the water while the divers were connecting and disconnecting the sub during launch and recovery. I always consider launch and recovery to be the most dangerous part of the whole operation, especially for us because we didn't have a system with a dedicated mothership that had a special handling system designed just for our vehicle. We had a chartered ship that basically, it was just a ship of opportunity, and it had a big crane that had the capacity to lift our sub in and out of the water, but they didn't have any special handling equipment on board to stabilize the sub. And like I say in the voiceover narration in the film, that thing could become a 12-ton wrecking ball in a heartbeat. And, you know, there were definitely some pulse-pounding moments getting that thing into the water and out of the water.
All right. Thank you, James. On the behalf of all the people gathered here in the Embassy Theatre in Wellington, we would like to express an appreciation for you taking time out from your family to speak to us tonight. And I think all of us today have seen something truly wonderful on the big screen. Thank you very much.
James Cameron live via Skype at the Embassy Theatre on Labour Monday, and Deep Sea Challenge 3D playing at still at select venues, and well worth a look because and the 3D is really an important factor in the success of this film. So if you are considering waiting for it to turn up on National Geographic Channel or whatever, you will miss a lot of the strength of the film and that 3D stuff. So we do recommend it, definitely.
Thank you, Dan. Studio Ghibli's Hayao Miyazaki received an honorary Oscar this week at the now annual Governor's Awards ceremony in Hollywood in front of a glittering array of stars.
And most of those stars are apparently all people who were lobbying hard amongst the Academy for their own nominations a little bit later on in the year. So, everybody, all the big stars who turned up were definitely being sort of eyeballed as contenders.
Also in the Lifetime Achievement list was 94-year-old Maureen O'Hara, who starred with John Wayne in The Quiet Man, among others, and Harry Belafonte.
And Harry Belafonte's speech is also online, and it's a very powerful, very powerful speech about the civil rights. So, yeah, worth a look. We'll stick that in the show notes. Maybe I should send a little email to myself to remind me.
Next year sees the 100th anniversary of the invention of Technicolor, and the Berlin Film Festival is celebrating that notable birthday, with a retrospective including Singin' in the Rain, Gone with the Wind, and The Wizard of Oz. 2- and 3-strip Technicolor was eventually superseded by the invention of color negative film in 1953. Other title screening include Duel in the Sun from 1944 and desert epic The Garden of Allah from 1936.
Now, the story that I found about this doesn't say whether they're actually going to be screening these on film, i.e. on Technicolor, or whether these are the digital restorations of these films. We've got here the Blu-rays of Wizard of Oz and Singin' in the Rain and Gone with the Wind, which we've watched as a family here, and I mean they're absolutely beautiful presentations of what, probably better than what the original Technicolor would be. But you'd think for something like this, maybe they'd want to go back, you know, with this whole fetishization of film that's going on these days. Maybe they would go back to those, but it doesn't say.
No, I do love Technicolor though; it holds a very special place in my heart. It's so beautiful.
Luminous
and bright and colors and, oh, I love it. Co-screenwriter of Interstellar, Chris Nolan's brother, Jonathan Nolan, is reported to have signed to write an adaptation of Isaac Asimov's famous Foundation novels for HBO. I don't know anything about them.
Okay, well, this is moderately exciting for me because as a kid, I loved those books and devoured. There's a series of them, perfect for HBO, like a kind of Game of Thrones thing in space, right? So, although without the bosoms and the blood, but the certainly a big sort of space opera, you know, lots of intrigue, lots of politics and lots of special effects. So, I'm really excited that someone's gone and done this. Less excited that it's him.
You had me at space opera. Matt Damon has finally confirmed that he will return to the Bourne franchise in 2016 when he will be the same age that Dan is now. So totally plausible, right? I don't know. You could be Bourne. You could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, just jump out some windows.
I just need the right. I just need the right stunt double, and we are there.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, so not such a bad idea after all. Matt Damon coming back.
Matt Damon.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth. You're the best pilot we ever had. Get out there and save the world.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system?
To our galaxy.
Here we go.
Kaylee, you and Ian went to see Interstellar. My first question for you about this is, did you go and see it on film or did you see it on digital?
We went to see it on digital at the big screen at the embassy.
Oh, okay. So that's the closest thing that Wellington has to an IMAX-y sort of experience, isn't it, really? If you sit up the front.
I suppose, yes. Yeah.
Right, because of course Christopher Nolan, the director, has been bashing away at this. If you want to see it, you really need to see it on film, sort of thing. And there is at least one cinema in Wellington that is screening it on film, but unfortunately, it's the cinema with the smallest screen.
But still, if you want to see it on film,
you can. Yeah,
In it didn't happen here. Everything was released at the same time, but in the States. Christopher Nolan said that only 35 prints could be screened in the first week, and then everyone else got in the second week, which caused a huge outrage, as it should have. Really. Yeah. Anyway,
totally. This is a man who doesn't like sitting down, so he doesn't allow any chairs on set. Like, really? And I'll tell you what, the other thing about Christopher Nolan is that this whole film is this perfect artistic creative medium. He has been so rude about the digital post-production process and the people who do it. Like, really quite mean-spirited to people who have worked their asses off to make that film. You know, like, there's not very much of that film that doesn't actually need somebody doing something digital. Like there's a mouse involved with almost every with every shot, right? And yet he's being a cock about it, frankly. And you know, apart from the fact that these films continue to make money, he's continuing to get funding to make films, and everyone needs a job, right? Why are people still working with him? Because it seems to me he's not a very respectful person of. You know, you should be respectful of every single stage of the process. But once you say, oh, I don't believe in digital intermediate colouring, or it's like all that effects work, which is basically making stuff happen that's in his head that could not happen any other way. I mean, his entire career is basically founded on stuff that you could not shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Arr, makes me mad. Anyway, that's
fine. It's also important to remember that actually shooting on film is very expensive, so it's quite elitist. You need the money to do that, so it's also kind of dickish in a way. If you're like only on film, it's like, well,
yeah. And okay, Tarantino's doing this as well now, and like Tarantino's saying that.
Didn't he sort of come around a little bit though?
No, well, he's bought a cinema. He's bought cinema in Beverly Hills, the name of which I can't quite remember, but which is only screens on 35mm in order to keep 35mm exhibition alive. He said that Crazy 8, his next film, is going to be shot on film and is going to be a big 70mm extravaganza, apparently.
Yes, digital in there.
Which theatre is it? Okay, thank you.
Our technical advisor just
he should text you is what we should.
Yeah, I know.
From the other room.
By the way, everyone listening, that was Ian, my partner, popping his head in to correct us because he's listening in the other room.
Yeah, and it's a good job because I would hate to be misleading people
or to be corrected on Twitter.
Yeah, true. Later.
That's actually
so bad.
Great. We love it.
Okay, so
that.
Ian has just whispered to us across the portal there that apparently there is digital at Quentin Tarantino Cinema in LA. So Maybe he's not. He likes the feel of the dollar bills as much as he likes the feel of celluloid. So anyway, Crazy 8's going to be this big 70 mil extravaganza. He's also saying that it's going to be his last film and he's retiring and blah, blah, blah.
Anyway, we digress. Back to Interstellar.
Yeah. What's it about, Kaylee?
So, Interstellar. It's in the future at some time, maybe not so distant. And humans have sucked everything out of the Earth. There's nothing left. Our planet is dying. And there is one spaceman who can save us all, and that's Matthew McConaughey.
So Matthew was previously a NASA pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Gun pilot, basically. Super,
Top Gun.
Awesome. Yeah, Top Gun. But because the world has turned its back on technology...
Yes.
For some reason, he's now farming. I think the argument is that food is so scarce that everybody has to be farming. Like if you're not farming, you're bleeding us dry.
Yes, and NASA had to go underground because it was a waste of money because people were starving, and you couldn't be spending money on space exploration and apparently this
happens very early in the film, so it's not really that much of a spoiler. Is one of the school teachers?
I love that
says
scene.
Says you know we teach that the moon landings were faked because they were, but also because we don't want people to get their hopes up that somehow technology is going to save anything, which is really interesting on a day like today where the European Space Agency just landed a washing machine on a
comet.
Rock on a comet, exactly, after
hurtling
10 years.
Through space.
I know. You know, this stuff is pretty cool. You know, it's like these things do push us forward and solve our problems. And, you know, I think that one of Interstellar's main sort of positions, you know, is exactly that, you know, we have to keep exploring because that's who we are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey, through some mysterious instructions given to him by a ghost. His house is haunted.
Yeah.
And he's this very intelligent
speaking to his daughter. Yeah.
So, yes, his ghost is speaking to his daughter. And that gives him the directions to go and find the underground NASA. Has his former, I guess, commissioner,
boss.
His
yeah.
former boss, who is played by Michael Caine. And yeah, he gets roped into shooting out into space with Anne Hathaway.
In no time flat.
They're just going out into space, which I appreciate. They're like, you know, we're getting on with it. We're moving it forward, even though this movie is almost 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And so they go on a mission into space to see if they can find other habitable planets? Other planets to live on, because there was a mission before them. People went out and they are going to go and meet those people and see if they're still alive.
There was a lot. At this point in time, there was an awful lot of sitting around a table talking about things that had happened before the film started. And also, when they pointed out, you know, there were portraits on the wall of the 12 astronauts that had gone to the 12 planets. We never got a close up of any of them. And I remember thinking at the time, that's because they don't want us to know who we're going to see later on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, so on that,
I feel like I can't say anything more about this film, or it'll go into sort of like
spoilery. It is spoilery, This is one of those tricky ones where, in order to really get your teeth into the argument about it, you sort of do need to wrap it up in one big ball and cover, because the way it ends is part of its problem, and the way it gets there is part of its problem, and the setup is actually it's actually kind of interesting.
I was entertained the entire time. I get really excited about like time, space, and like relativity theory and, you know, astronomy and all that stuff. I find it really exciting. I find the science really exciting. So I wish it went into that in a more intelligent way instead of a very simple, like, this is relativity theory.
Which they then repeated several times just so that they made sure you got it. It was like, I don't know. It was like eighth grade quantum physics, you know, repeated over and over again.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nolan's... look, I have a real problem with Nolan's screenwriting ability. I just think he has very little. And the so much of this film felt like that endless walk in the streets of Paris in I keep wanting to call it insurrection. No, what was it called?
Inception.
Insipid. institutionalized. The endless walk with Ellen Page and Leonardo DiCaprio, where he has to explain the entire thing so that she understands it, so that we understand it. And like, it just seemed to me that the whole film was like that over and over again.
Yeah, and I wanted it to be really intelligent, and I wanted it to be good, and exciting, and sort of, you know, be an intelligent movie about these things. But of course, it's, you know, it's a Nolan film, and we were discussing last week off air that's like, you know, you get really excited to go into a Nolan film, you get all caught up in it, you come out, you're sort of buzzing, and you think about it for a couple of days, you're like, oh, actually, no, there wasn't much going on, was there? But I do have to say, I did appreciate, and I did appreciate in Inception as well, the way that he plays with space and time, and especially in this one. I mean, I know it's a bit hokey, but I thought it was kind of cool, but I was caught up in the moment.
I think there is a great film to be made about relativity and the loss of that, you know, or the loss that entails. The fact that, you know, that those rules of time and space are, as far as we know, immutable. And if we send people off to do these things, that's it, you know, like we will be gone by the time they come home. And I do think that there is a film that could address that sort of pain that entails. And I think that this one sort of tiptoed over the edge and then decided not to jump in and it sort of found a way to magic itself out of it.
Yeah, the end was disappointing.
Yeah, and the end where... I don't need to go into specifics about where Matthew McConaughey ends up, but it's basically, it was just like a space version of that foldy Paris folding in on itself thing again. It's like Nolan must have had a dream once where that happened, because that's twice now he's used basically the same visual motif for something completely fantastical. Either that or... he doesn't have that much of an imagination, which I don't think is true, because I think he sort of does. Like the landing on the planet that's all water, you know, I thought that was a really effective, like, you know, he can direct, and he can, certainly the team he's got around him to edit, you know, that was a tense as sequence, but in service of kind of what, when it sort of flies in the face of its own internal logic at times. This has been called Nolan's most sentimental film, you know.
I was so beating you over the head with it.
Yeah, it's almost as if...
too many monologues. Ugh. Yeah. I love Anne Hathaway. I'm one of... for some reason, there are a lot of women out there who hate Anne Hathaway. I don't know why. It's like specifically women. I love her. But in this, I just felt so bad for her. Like, her character was doing really well up to a point, and then she just completely failed as a feminist character. And I was like, oh. That's it. You were like this awesome scientist. And now you're just a housewife.
Exactly. So many problems, so many things to argue with. You know, at least we should be grateful that a big budget film that is ostensibly aimed at grown-ups, that isn't based on a prior franchise or
a young adult novel.
Yeah, or a young adult novel, which is like... but you'd have to say that... in some ways, The Hunger Games did a better job of not beating you over the head with its themes than this did.
And we're going to review Hunger Games
next week, absolutely. Well, actually, let's hope so. It doesn't open on a Thursday?
Oh, yeah. We go to the midnight screening on Wednesday.
We could do that, definitely.
I don't know if I can do that. We could try, though. That'd be fun.
But there may well be a radio screening somewhere. Anyway, this is us doing some little management planning live in front of you, revealing how the show gets put together. Normally this would be an email conversation on like a Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah, this is real life, people. Yeah,
we wouldn't be thinking this far ahead normally. But anyway, so next week, yeah, the Hunger Games.
This is how good. We just keep talking about completely different things. We're clearly struggling with Interstellar.
Well, okay, so I'm going to ask you a question about this because I pondered this. I love Matthew McConaughey as an actor, but do you?
Do you?
Yes. Well, maybe not as an actor, maybe as a screen presence. Like, but was he the right person for this? Did you buy him as the smartest guy in the room?
Well, I didn't buy him as the smartest guy in the room, but I definitely bought him as this, to, you know, another film title, a space cowboy who just knows what to do. He can get it done with like quick and dirty tricks. But I'm not a huge Matthew McConaughey fan. Like, he was amazing in Dallas Buyers Club. Like, he's had some amazing characters, but,
Oh, now that he's an actor again, I think it's okay. But, cause Mudd, I was just watching a little bit of that, a while ago and you know, Mudd, a terrific performance from him in that. Yeah. And Dallas Buyers, obviously, but I don't know. Or maybe the.
I don't know who else I'd put in there, though. I don't know who I would cast.
Well, you start with Clooney and you work your way down, don't you, really?
But you can't be Clooney. It can't be Clooney because he did Gravity.
Oh, I know. Exactly. So, yeah, well, this is it. Downey Jr.
Nope.
No. Christian Bale probably would have been who it was written for, to be honest. Isn't Christian Bale Nolan's muse?
But then that would have been, like, too close to Batman with Michael Caine.
No, he's got, but he does have this sort of, the people that he loves to work with, including his brother as a screenwriter and his
wife.
What
if it was Marion Cotillard? What if it was a female instead of a male lead?
I know. Huh? I know. Well, I mean, she's out of work at the moment because I've just seen 2 days, one night. So she's, she's
free.
Yeah, she's free. Exactly. And probably cheap. But anyway, we'll talk about 2 days, one night next week as well, because that opens very soon. We're drifting, aren't we?
We are.
Drifting in space.
Like Matthew McConaughey leaving a spaceship. We are drifting out into the space around Interstellar.
Now, I want to come back to digital versus film here because I can't quite picture how film would make it look any better. Like, I just don't buy, as a general rule, for me, if you shoot on film and project digitally, it's great. You don't have the flicker.
If you shoot on 70 mil.
Yeah, or IMAX or whatever it is that you're shooting on. Yeah, I know. I just don't get how going to a cinema after, let's say you go to that a week after it opens, right? On a big screen, the film's starting to warp, the sprocket holes are worn, flicker. It does. Going through celluloid, it's imperceptible in lots of ways, but there's dirt and scratches and all
but
of that
you,
sort of
do
stuff.
Do you remember once upon a time, Dan, when you were like staving off the digital revolution and you were like all about the film?
No, I wasn't.
I
one
remember.
Of those people.
Yeah, you were. You were.
I think
I remember. But you turned quickly.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you.
Because you're like, you know what? Actually, it looks amazing because it every run looks like the first run.
Well, that was it because there was a time when I used to, when I started reviewing films, I'd go to the first screening on a Thursday morning of a film and it looked perfect, But you go to often with film we were getting them second hand here in New Zealand, or they were festival prints that were travelling around, and they were beaten to shit, frankly. And it was hard work. It was hard work watching them. Hard work paying attention and keeping your attention span. And with digital, it is always the same. Now there are still problems with ratios. You've still got not everybody has the same. Paying the same amount of attention to things like lamp life and all those problems that cinemas have. They're trying to cut costs, but on a basic level, digital, it just seems to work. It works for me now. I don't even think about it, and sometimes I'll look at something and I go, that doesn't look like film. But even you I was talking to Karen the other night about we watched Collateral last night on Blu-ray, and I remember when Collateral came out, that's 2004, hating it. Not hating the film, but hating the digital, because it was the first big film shot on high definition. And the cameras weren't really up to low light situations, so there was a lot of, it looked like a handy cam when they went into the dark. And the lenses weren't good enough and all of those sorts of things. And it sort of got in the way for me of how good the film actually is. But then, was it maybe just over a year ago, we watched Skyfall, which of course was shot on digital, and all those night scenes in Shanghai, absolutely incredible. And that's how far the capture, the digital capture, has come. I never watched a moment of Skyfall not thinking that I was watching film, you know. Mm. Like, oh, maybe Nolan just got the hives watching it, but I enjoyed it, right?
No, but it also comes down to the color correction of it. You can add layers and effects to look, make it look more filmic and cinematic. So
yeah, yeah. And I don't really want to know how they do that stuff. I just want to know, you know it's that there's somebody with an aesthetic there that's looking after these things. But watching Collateral again last night, I really appreciated it for what it was. Instead of wishing that it looked more like film, maybe it was the fact that it wasn't blown up to a giant screen and it was just here at home. But even on Blu-ray, it looked great. The colors are fantastic, and it had a real it had a commitment to its own choices, which I really appreciated. And you know, if you haven't seen it, listeners, do check it out, because it is one of the great films of the last 10 years, probably 2004, and a film that, if it came out now, we would be all over like a rash. We would be absolutely loving it. But I suspect, you know, that time has dimmed it a little bit, but it's worth it. Michael Mann and Jamie Foxx, Michael Mann directing, Jamie Foxx, and of course Tom Cruise, whose name vacated my mind just for a moment.
Right, he'll
be, that's of course, that's his ears will be burning now. But yeah, just a fantastic, fantastic film, and you know, really smart script, really well directed, beautifully cut. And I had forgotten who else was in it. You know, like Mark Ruffalo turns up. There's a scene, the very first scene in the film is at LAX airport, and Jason Statham's in it for one scene. He's like, wow, I don't remember you. Of course, you probably wasn't actually a star then. So, but Collateral, really well cast, just the top film all around. So there we go. That fills our quota for the week of the and more.
Yes. And I was going to say, speaking of good films about science and technology, depending on where you saw it and what trailers that cinema had, The Imitation Game, which is now being trailered, which I saw, fantastic.
Right.
Fantastic.
And The Imitation Game is about the code breaking at Alan Turing, is that right?
Yes, about Alan Turing breaking the Enigma code with his, basically one of the first computers ever built.
Right, and we've also got a film coming up a little bit later on in the year about Stephen Hawking, you know, which,
oh my gosh,
which may or may well not have any science in it, because who knows whether they choose to, you know, do a personal life story or, you know, investigate some of the science. We'll wait and see about that. But, you know, films are getting smarter, should be getting smarter. And it seemed to me, coming back to the topic at hand, that Interstellar isn't nearly as smart as it wants to tell you over and over and over again that it is. It's like, you know, somebody who's read a few books and has just had this flash of insight that just, you know, it is actually isn't that insightful.
Or they've read some the back covers of some science books, and they're convinced they know everything about it, and they're going to tell you in a really condescending way.
Yeah, it is condescending, definitely.
But to be fair, I was entertained. I got caught up in it. I enjoyed myself at the movie. So it's one of those things. It's like you enjoy it while you're there, and then you walk away, and you're like, actually,
that's true. That is true. I
think that's the Nolan effect.
I didn't enjoy it as much as you did, but I look back to sort of this time last year when Karen and I went to see Gravity for the first time, and nearly crushed each other's hands. It was so tense, you know. Like that's what films. You know, we have to. Sometimes we have to be reminded that that's what films can do. That's what the effect, you know, of a fantastical thing like that can be. And so, and Interstellar never got me on that level at all. You know, I was never gripped.
No, but if you want gripping films.
Mm-hmm.
This is my Tell You About episode. January, we are getting a dearth of films, some of my favorite films that I saw on my film festival road trip. So hang on for January, because it's going to be amazing.
All right.
Thank you to Flix for having that information up.
And you're probably going to be doing sneak previews of those on your Radio New Zealand slot on Sunday.
Very, very tiny ones, so I can still leave space for Simon Morris to do them in January, but I do get...
And you'll be able to do them properly here, because we have so much time. Here we are, we're almost over the hour. In fact, we are. We're over the hour already. We promised that this would be a shorter show. So let's bring this little sucker into land, if you like.
Mm.
And do you have two words for Interstellar?
Oh, I did, but now they escape me.
So. Okay, well, my two words for Interstellar are undercooked.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's rare, isn't it? This is like a look of surprise on your face. Oh, it's quite a good one.
I had something really clever. I had two of them, and now I can't even remember them. But, you know, so I guess sort of like the film, it's a bit forgettable. So.
Yeah, write them down.
Mm.
Yeah, that's my advice to everybody, actually, just as a general rule for life.
Mm.
Write it down.
Mm.
Okay, that is our show for this week. Next week, The Hunger Games and 2 Days, 1 Night with Marion Cotillard. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us with email, or you can make a comment on the website. People have done that as well.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, where we will be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. And I'm totally pimping my Radio NZ gig. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too. Our username is Rancho Notorious.
Yeah, and you can find all of the other episodes of the show at the website as well. And I recommend you go back to last week's All-Star Salute to Studio Ghibli. Have a listen to some of the really interesting things that people, our guests said about that, and you'll find out about how to enter our competition. We've got a whole lot of Madman supplied Studio Ghibli Blu-rays and art books, so we are looking for entries for that, and we'll keep the competition open for another couple of weeks. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 2 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Loz Plantronics, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. Actually, this is kind of dull information, but it was a pain in the ass to me this afternoon. The Interstellar soundtrack by Hans Zimmer is only available as a pre-order on the iTunes store, so you can't actually buy it yet, which means I can't play you anything. Kind of a blessing in disguise, really, because I actually hated that music really, really badly. So I thought I would be inspired by Collateral, which we watched last night. So here's one of the tracks that features in that film, Paul Oakenfold's Korean Style, also known as Ready, Steady, Go. Special thanks to my partner, Karen, who makes sure that everyone who visits with us here at Rancho Notorious is well-fed, well-watered, well-looked after.
Special thanks to my partner, Ian, for correcting us on that.
Yeah, we need to find it. Yeah, we need to find it. Maybe he could pass notes under the door. That would be...
I think you should just come in and talk into the mic. We'll just leave it on every week for him.
Well, we have a third mic. That's exactly. Yeah, yeah, he could be like he could be like Paul Schaefer and the CBS Orchestra in the late night with Letterman.
Give him a keyboard.
He could just. All right. Well, that's just an awesome, awesome idea. All right. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to you, Kaylee. It's been a pleasure. That's good evening from me, Dan Slevin.
And good evening from me, Kaylee Carruthers.